carts in to haul out the art. Time was at a premium. As it was, they'd still have to load the artwork into the ambulance and fake crime scene van. He started, "We need the carts," but his voice froze. These men weren't the men he'd hired, and they were clearly wearing body armor under their uniforms. Police! Shit! With a slam in his gut, he understood that he'd been outsmarted. Somebody had figured out that a robbery was going down and called the police. The cops had arrived silently, found the phony paramedics outside, overpowered them, then dressed two officers in medic overalls as point men for a takedown team, which would of course be sprinting up the stairs right now. The two cops crouched, weapons drawn. "Shoot, shoot, shoot!" Bob cried to his partner, who started firing toward the two officers, the ring of brass on the stone floor nearly as loud as the silenced report of his Beretta. Bob's strategy was to wound as many in the crowd as he could, forcing the tactical team to stop and give them aid. He could get out through the back via an emergency route he'd planned earlier. Frank, too, if he was able, but that was up to him. The cop closest to him had his back turned, aiming at Frank. Bob lifted his gun to shoot the cop in the spine, but as he did, he heard a slap of feet behind him and thought, "Oh, hell!" An instant later, he was tumbling to the floor after a shoulder caught him low and hard, right in the kidneys. A flash of yellow light burst in his eyes, an explosion of pain. Bob gasped, breath completely knocked out of him. None, of course it was none, ripped the pistol from his hand. As Bob, writhing on the floor, reached desperately for the weapon, None delivered an elbow to his nose. He collapsed, stunned and groaning in pain, blood spewing from his nose. Frank noticed him and spun around, shooting, but his aim was wild and he missed his target, instead shooting his partner Bob in the chest. None stood his ground, drew a target, and dropped Frank with three well-placed rounds. Then he immediately spun back to cover Bob, but Bob was already dead. Being a cop is more about talking than shooting or chasing down criminals. Well, not just talking, asking questions. The next day, John Nunn was at the museum again. Captain Harvey Meyer, who was leading the investigation into the previous night's attempted robbery, had called him earlier in the afternoon. The two men had known each other back when Nunn was still at the SFPD, and when Meyer heard Nunn had been there last night during the attempted robbery, he asked Nunn to be present while he questioned Justine Olegard at her office in the museum. Nunn knew from his time on the force that Meyer had a reputation for the unconventional, and didn't bother to question why Meyer would want an ex-cop there. He just showed up. Justine, it seemed, had called both Tony Olson and, to Nunn's surprise and dismay, Stan Ballard to her meeting with Meyer. Justine explained Ballard's presence by saying he was the only lawyer she knew. She hadn't been accused of anything per se, but the number of felonies that had gone down in the tower yesterday meant that there were plenty of penal code violations to go around for everyone. Nunn hadn't even been aware that Justine and Ballard knew each other, and realized it must have been from her time with Christopher Thomas. Still, it was odd that Ballard, an estate lawyer, would agree to be there and not refer her to someone else. But Nunn suspected Ballard was there for Ballard only. Justine was going out of her way to be cooperative, but there didn't seem to be anything she could add to what Meyer already knew. "I'm sorry," Justine said. "I spent all night looking through security tapes and poring over reports about, you know, people casing out the museum over the past few months. I couldn't find any pictures or descriptions of them." Her voice was soft, eyes distant. And Nunn knew it was because she had had to use as references the pictures shot last night of the dead thieves. Her boss, Alex Hultgren, had also been killed. "Who called the police?" she asked Meyer. Meyer pointed to Nunn. Nunn explained how he'd been near the staircase after Haley had been hurt, and looked down into the lobby and thought it was odd to have crime scene officers there. Then he heard the screams in the tower room and realized the museum was being hit. Meyer asked Justine,
"Are you sure you've never seen those men before?"
"I don't think so. I've looked at those pictures so many times I can't be sure of anything anymore."
Meyer looked at Nunn questioningly, but Nunn's mind was elsewhere. He kept thinking about the text message he'd received earlier in the day. It didn't seem possible. His BlackBerry buzzed. Nunn picked it up, then he looked at Meyer.
"Can I talk to you outside for a second?"
They stepped out into the hallway. "Look, on my way over here, I got a text from a friend which gave me a new theory about what happened here last night."
"And?"
Meyer asked.
"You're going to think I'm nuts, Harvey. Tell me."
"My friend's down in the lobby. I'm going to have him come up here."
"I'll let him tell you.
It's quite a story."
Chapter 27 by Kathy Reichs. Staccato footsteps clicked across marble. Everyone's eyes swung toward a figure framing up in the door. The man wore a Duke sweatshirt and cargo pants tucked into platform boots. His left hand gripped a leather briefcase that looked as if it left Spain before the Civil War. Nunn made introductions.
"Gentlemen, Justine, may I present Dr. Ignatius McGee."
McGee was leading man handsome, with a square jaw, blue eyes, and hair that left Brosnan in the styling gel dust. Only one unfortunate base pair sequence barred him from a star on the Hollywood Walk. If he stood ramrod straight, which he was, Ignatius McGee was no more than 4'6". 2 of those inches belonged to the boots. Palms were pressed. Then the group sat. McGee, too, left ankle crossed onto opposite knee, right foot not quite touching the floor. Everyone dragged chairs into a semicircle, grad seminar style, except for Stan Ballard, who was leaning against the wall, stone-faced. Nunn got right to the point.
"Dr. McGee is a forensic anthropologist. Everyone clear on what that is?"
"Bones," Justine Olegard said, "but not old ones." Nunn swept an upturned palm in McGee's direction.
"Take it away."
"The answer's spot on," said McGee.
"I'm a specialist in the human skeleton."
The accent was blue-collar Boston, the voice surprisingly deep for a man McGee's size.
"I work the dead too far gone for a Y incision. The burned, mummified, decomposed, dismembered, mutilated, and skeletonized. I dig 'em up, ID 'em, determine how they bought it, and when."
Olson rocketed forward, fingers squeezing his armrests.
"You exhumed Christopher Thomas."
McGee studied him, then slid his eyes left.
"An exhumation wasn't possible," Nunn explained. "At my request, Dr. McGee analyzed the dossier compiled at the time of Thomas's death."
"Wasn't everything written in German?"
Olson asked.
"I had the reports translated,"
McGee said.
"And you found proof of Rosemary's innocence?" Olson said.
Irritation filed the edge of McGee's rich baritone.
"Who else thinks he knows how my movie ends?"
Olson flicked an angry glance at Nunn.
"Who the hell is this guy?"
Nunn raised 2 placating palms.
"Let Dr. McGee walk us through his findings without interruption. Then you can ask all the questions you want. Okay?"
Face locked into neutral, Olson settled back. Twisting sideways, McGee swung his case to the desktop and withdrew 2 folders, one brown and battered, the other bright pink and Office Max new. Setting the former aside, he flipped the cover on the latter.
"The original paperwork is here if anyone spreck Deutsch. My comments will focus on my interpretation of the evidence."
Not pausing to gauge reaction, McGee pulled a multi-page document from the folder.
According to the pathologist, he flipped to the back, one Bruno Munz, the remains were soup and bones, rendering visual identification impossible. Most of the teeth were toast.
McGee's gaze crawled the faces of those fanned out before him. Frowning, he ran a hand across his perfectly formed jaw.
Munz was unable to determine cause of death. Understandable, due to decomp and damage inflicted by the maiden, the body was hamburger. No Germanic pun intended.
The corners of McGee's mouth twitched in what might have been a grin. No one smiled back.
Where Munz erred big time was in failing to solicit the opinion of a specialist. In going solo on the anthro, he jumped into dung way over his head.
McGee took a mustard-colored envelope from his briefcase, unwound the string, and fanned out a dozen autopsy photos onto the desktop. Four chairs scooted forward as one.
Fortunately, Munz had a kick-ass photographer.
This is a close-up showing what remained of the victim's left hand.
Missing from each digit is the distal phalange, the little arrow-shaped bugger that underlies the fingertip.
McGee rotated a print for the benefit of those opposite.
Anything strike you as odd?
No one ventured an opinion. Snatching up a pen, McGee pointed to the tubular bones that had once formed fingers.
Look at the first four sets of phalanges.
Everyone did. McGee rotated another photo, this one showing the bones of a single digit.
These are the bones of the left fifth finger after removal of the soft tissue. Again, look at the phalanges.
The fingertip is present, said Olson.
Yes. This was the digit that yielded the one partial print. What else?
These bones seem skinnier and smoother than the ones in the other fingers, and they flare out more at the ends, said Justine.
Head of the class, little lady.
Normally, Olegard would have bristled at the little lady endearment. Given McGee's stature, she let it slide.
What does it mean? Olson asked, eyes glued to the photos.
McGee ignored him and produced a magnifying lens from the briefcase. He handed it to Justine, along with the first autopsy shot of digits 1 through 4.
Note, there are tiny slashes at the ends of each of the first four middle phalanges.
Leaning forward, McGee reached out and shifted his pen from thumb to pointer to middle to ring man. Justine followed its progress with the lens.
The horizontal lines? She asked.
Yes. Those are cut marks created by a non-serrated blade. The marks are absent on the middle phalanx of the pinky, but present on its proximal phalanx, the one at the near end. Cut marks are also present on the fifth metacarpal, adjacent to where the finger articulates with the hand.
So, the left pinky was the only digit to retain its tip, and to have no cut marks at the end? Justine said. She addressed no one in particular, as though sifting data in her mind. The left pinky was also the only digit to have cut marks at the end, where the finger joined the hand.
Again, the little lady nailed it.
The little lady handed the photo and lens to Olson. May I hypothesize? Justine asked, encouraged by McGee's smile in her direction. McGee dipped his chin. Justine took it as assent. The fingertips were removed from every digit but the left pinky. That finger was severed intact.
Bravo.
Meyer performed an eye roll directed at Nunn.
Are you believing this lunatic? You're saying the killer hacked off 9 of Thomas's fingertips, but cut off his left pinky and left it intact? No,
McGee said. I am not.
Meyer's brows reached for his hairline.
Moving on. Muntz based his positive ID on three things.
McGee raised a hand and moved a stumpy thumb from finger to finger.
First, the presence of a belt buckle belonging to Christopher Thomas. Second, a match to a partial print taken from a left fifth finger. Third, consistency between the skeletal profile obtained from the remains and Christopher Thomas's known age, sex, race, and height.
McGee replaced the hand bone shots with views of the skull. As before, he pinpointed at features in the photo.
Short, globular head shape, wide face, flaring cheekbones, broad palate and nasal opening, complicated zigzag suture pattern, accessory bone at the back of the skull. To me, that configuration screams mongoloid.
Blank looks.
Those traits indicate Asian or Native American ancestry.
Slowly, teacher to dull pupils.
You saying Thomas was Asian?
Tony Olson made no effort to mask his skepticism.
McGee ignored the interruption. Muntz made another error. In calculating stature, he relied on only one bone, the femur. He then chose an inappropriate formula for performing a regression equation and misinterpreted the statistical significance of the estimate that equation generated. I remeasured leg bone lengths using the scale provided in the photographs and recalculated stature, applying statistics appropriate to Asians. My height estimate for the decedent is 162 to 168 centimeters. Christopher Thomas measured 183 centimeters.
What about the print? Tiny vessels had blossomed in Tony Olson's cheeks. Fingerprints don't lie.
I have to admit that bothered me too. Iggy, I said to myself, it doesn't add up. Or does it? What's the pattern? You got a boatload of dots. Now link them together.
Again, a stumpy thumb worked stumpy fingers, ticking off points.
Dot. The Vic is supposed to be a tall white guy, but his skull says he's Asian, and his leg bones say he's too short. Dot. The left fifth finger bones look different from all the other finger bones. Smoother and more gracile in the shafts and broader at the ends. Dot. Every fingertip was removed but the one on the left fifth finger. Dot. Nine digits were reduced to bone, but the left fifth finger retained its soft tissue.
McGee did his best at crossing his arms on his chest. Didn't go well.
Then I remembered. The glycerin.
Mystified looks all around.
McGee scanned the text, then read aloud from Muntz's autopsy report. One digit was deeply embedded in the femoroacetabular junction.
Not a single aha expression. Scooching forward with an alternating cheek-to-cheek maneuver, McGee teased a photo from the assortment cascading over the desktop, grabbed the lens, and gestured everyone close.
The bone in this shot forms the left half of the pelvis. That deep, round hole below the blade is where the head of the thigh bone sits. The joint is called the femoroacetabular junction. That socket is protected by very thick muscle. Soft tissue is often preserved there long after the rest of the flesh sloughs. You with me?
Nods all around. Satisfied, McGee positioned the lens over the pelvic photo.
What do you see circling the hip socket?
Cut marks, said Olson.
Exactly.
McGee laid down the lens. Justine picked it up and drew her nose and the glass to within inches of the print. The others assumed listening postures.
Here's my take. Bruno Munz screwed up the ID. The man in the Iron Maiden was not Christopher Thomas. The victim was an Asian male of roughly Thomas's age and size, but slightly shorter in stature. The man's teeth were destroyed to prevent dental identification. His fingertips were removed to eliminate prints. His left fifth finger was replaced by that of someone else. Incisions were made into the gluteal mass of the Asian victim, rather clumsy ones, I might add. Thomas's finger was coated with glycerin and fat to retard decomposition, then jammed through the muscle deep into the dead man's hip socket.
And Munz blew this whole phalange bone thing? Tony Olson flapped a hand at the photos. The missing fingertips? Distal phalanges are tiny, often missed in recovery. If he noticed their absence, which I doubt, the good doctor probably thought they'd gotten lost. Perhaps he didn't bother to sift through all the sludge in the Maiden. Thomas's belt with recognizable buckle was placed on the victim. The body, sans fingertips but cum Thomas's pinky, was sealed inside the Iron Maiden. The apparatus was crated and shipped. The rest is history.
The mismatched bones? The cut marks? Tony Olson's cheeks were now the color of raspberry sherbet.
Munz was a pathologist, not an anthropologist. The man overstepped his abilities.
But, Justine sat forward, one of Christopher Thomas's teeth was found inside the Iron Maiden, wasn't it? And that was proved.
Right again, little lady.
McGee gave her an odd, lopsided smile.
It was Christopher Thomas's tooth. And it surely did not come out of the Asian man's mouth.
Silence. Olson was the first to break it. If you're right, someone took brutal measures to ensure that the victim would be misidentified as Christopher Thomas. McGee nodded.
Who?
Tony Olson.
Why?
Meyer. McGee's shoulders rose and dropped.
Beats me.
All eyes turned to John Nunn. But Nunn was looking at Stan Ballard. It was Olson who voiced the question on everyone's mind.
Then, where the hell is Christopher Thomas?
Chapter 28 by R.L. Stine.
I know where to find them. I know more about everything than all of them. I found Peter Hewson easily. No prob. Rented a rubber dinghy with a putt-putt motor and sailed out to his cabin cruiser moored near the St. Francis Yacht Club. Typical San Francisco day, foggy and damp, the water choppy, blue-brown under the clouds. I could see the Golden Gate Bridge off to my right, but I didn't come for sightseeing. 12 years later, and I knew how happy Hewson would be to see me. Peter must be in his 50s now, I figured, and richer than God. Thanks in part to me. As I came closer, I saw him seated by himself at a table on the back deck. He had a wine glass in his hand. He stood up when he saw me and stepped to the rail. "You remember me?" I shouted. He didn't look much older. Money'll do that for you. He was in a white admiral's jacket. He had a blue yachting cap pulled down on his head. I mean, what was this? Halloween? I couldn't see if he still had his hair, but he looked tanned and fit. Of course he recognized me. He began waving his arms in front of him like signaling an alarm. "Ruby, I don't want to see you," he shouted. "Turn around. Go back. You're not welcome here." Of course he didn't want to see me. I scrambled onto the deck and tied the dinghy to the side. The sun came out for a moment, and everything started to gleam, like a spotlight shining on me. Time for my close-up. I thought maybe he had some flunkies who would come push me off the yacht, but he appeared to be alone. I have nothing to say to you, he said as I stepped up to his table. You're not welcome here. Why have you come? Peter, come on. I thought you'd be more friendly. I couldn't keep a smile off my face. I mean, I did a very big favor for you. Beneath the cap, his forehead creased. His pale eyes narrowed. Favor for me? I don't know what you're talking about. I know who you are, but you never did anything for me. Why, just the other day, some guy finds me, starts asking me questions about the favor I did for you. What? Peter squealed. Don't worry. I had him taken care of. Peter looked worried now. Did you really think that lousy 10K was going to last me forever? I sat down at the table. I picked up his wine glass and took a long sip. Is this a Chablis? I can call the harbor police. I've had intruders before. I picked up a biscuit from the silver bread basket, still warm. I took a bite. Now, are you really going to pretend you don't know anything? He stood over me. His lips began to twitch. I don't have to pretend. I didn't have anything to do with it. Amnesia? Let me help you. I decided to go for it. The body in the Iron Maiden? Hewson swallowed, but he didn't blink. Excuse me, are you insane? Jeez, how long are you going to keep up this charade? I'm going to call the patrol now. Oh, I know who you're going to call. And it won't be no police. He made a move toward the cabin, but I grabbed his arm. Just sit down. Let's be civilized, Peter. Tell you what. I'll tell you a story, and you sit there and pretend you don't already know it. I had to pull him down to the chair. I'll give you 5 minutes, he said, still play-acting. But he was sweating. What's your story? Yeah, let's say it's a story, I said. Let's pretend it's not all total truth. He stared at the wine glass in my hand. I tilted it to my mouth and drank the rest. Peter, let's say there was once an Iron Maiden in a museum in San Francisco. Let's say it was built hundreds of years ago, but used recently. I'm not a history buff. Hewson interrupted, shaking his head. You're wasting your time. Well, I did my homework after the fact. I ran my finger around the rim of the empty wine glass. Hewson started to his feet. You're out of here. I pushed him back down. I had to be a little rough. I could see a flash of fear on his face. His tan had disappeared. Let's say there was a dead man stuffed inside the thing. That's very old news. Hewson muttered. Why did you come here? I brought my face up close to his. Is it old news, Peter? What if I told the story, the whole story? What if I call the police? That got to him. I saw two red circles blossom on his cheeks. Why would you do that, Artie? His eyes danced around as if he were looking for a way to escape. It was a lot of years ago. Why would you go to the police now? Do I look desperate to you? I asked, leaning close to him again. Well, I am. I am desperate. I know what you think. You think I'm a piece of low-life scum who crawled onto your big yacht like a cockroach, but I know some pretty big words for a cockroach. Like accessory. You know, like in accessory to murder. Hewson was breathing hard. Under the admiral's jacket, his chest heaved up and down. You wouldn't dare, he whispered. You would turn yourself in, admit to murder, and drag me down with you? I nodded. I was enjoying this. I told you. I'm desperate. Hewson's shoulders slumped. He narrowed his eyes until they were thin slits. What do you want, Artie? Money? Yes. Good guess. I want money. A lot of it. Okay, okay. Money. And then you'll go away? That went very well. Now I had one more call I wanted to make. One more call before I left town for good. I had a fat wad of money from Houston. But I wanted more. A lot more. I needed to make the call. Call it closure, or call it my sadistic streak, or maybe a victory lap. And more money. I'd gotten the number out of that cowardly worm Peter. I punched it in eagerly. Hello? I recognized the voice right away. I have information on Christopher Thomas. A silence, then. Who? Don't you recognize my voice? You have the wrong number. I don't think so, I said. I'm sorry, you have the wrong number. He hung up. I laughed. It felt good to laugh. Call you back later, I said into the silent phone. I pulled on a jacket and headed out. Chapter 29 by Jeffrey Deaver. With his four-fingered hand, Christopher Thomas poured ancient Remy Martin cognac into a glass, obviously bought at Walmart. The Trompe L'Oeil Hotel, a good one, had scrimped on a few details. Still, it made sense. It was logical. Nice booze, cheap delivery. He glanced into the large window at his own reflection. Even after nearly 10 years with his new appearance, he was never completely used to this version of himself. Not that he disliked what he saw. The plastic surgeon had been an artist. Dr. 90210. A zip code, he reflected, whose numbers represented about one-third of the doctor's bill. Now he looked past his image and gazed through the early evening dusk. He was angry, and he was troubled. He'd heard on the news, of course, about the bungled robbery at the museum last night, and had gotten brief text messages from Peter Hewson about the debacle. The sloppy keyboarding suggested the man had been drinking. Thomas sighed. The theft had been so perfectly planned, the haul so astonishing. When Hewson had heard that Tony Olson was putting together a memorial for Rosemary, Christopher and Hewson had immediately put together a plan that would allow them to snag one of the biggest troves in the history of art. Works by Da Vinci and Michelangelo, mostly, but also by Rembrandt, Watteau, Rubens, Tiepolo, and Delatour. Christopher had buyers for virtually all the pieces in place, and the net to him, after expenses, would have been millions. But it had all turned to dust. And topping off the tragedy, just today he'd received that phone call. I have information on Christopher Thomas. Information? Christopher Thomas had been murdered by his wife and stuffed into an Iron Maiden. Christopher Thomas was dead and buried. Christopher Thomas was a faded memory, a despised or hated or, in a few cases, envied memory. That's all the information he wanted anyone to have. But he knew the caller. A noise behind him intruded. He swiveled around to see Tanya. No, her name was Taylor, right? Pulling her tiny dress back on. When he'd yanked the handful of lycra off her an hour ago and flung it to the floor, he'd been focusing on her supple body and trying to forget about the failed heist. The sex was supposed to distract him from the loss. It had zero effect, and he blamed her for that.
Ooh, she said, eyeing the cognac. I want a Cosmo.
No, leave. She blinked.
Well, you're not very nice,
in a little girl's sing-song tone. He walked away, ignoring her. He heard her pull together her things and leave, sighing loudly. Who cared? There'd be more Tanyas. Wait, Taylors. He called Hewson again, using the untraceable prepaid mobiles that they relied on in their operations. Finally, an answering click.
Hello?
Said the slurred voice. You haven't been answering me,
Thomas snapped. The police have been taking statements from everybody. You've been drinking. Now is not the time to get drunk. What's going on? Do they suspect anything?
About us? I don't know. I didn't hang around at the museum to find out.
Where are you? What are you doing now?
Sitting on the boat, getting drunk.
Well, Thomas said slowly, I think we'll be fine. There's been no personal contact.
Absolutely no connection.
How'd they figure it out?
I don't know.
Hewson was a snake and a drunk. But he wasn't fundamentally stupid. After all, the two men had been stealing art for the past decade and had managed to avoid the smartest cops and insurance investigators in the business. Thomas said, I think everything will be fine. We'll let the dust settle, lay low for a while.
Yeah. Lay low.
Thomas disconnected, resisting the urge to pitch his glass against the wall. He sat down and stared out the window. Thinking back to the days when Christopher Thomas had an ever-growing need for money and mistresses, and all the while Rosemary had been growing more and more impatient with him, less willing to dole out her family money to him. So Thomas began to reconsider his future. As a curator, he'd forged connections with shady businessmen and criminals around the world, and had learned about the huge market for private art placements. Tidy euphemism, that. People thought that some paintings were so famous that they were safe from theft. Ha! But they didn't know about men. Always men, it seemed. In Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Iran, China, Japan, Malaysia, and India, with limitless funds and a lust for owning genius. They never showed the art in public. Sometimes they didn't show it at all. The passion was about possessing what someone else could not. And so Thomas came up with his idea, inspired by the Iron Maiden. He and Hewson, with the help of Artie Ruby, who worked for Christopher, would fake his death and slip another body into the device, and Ruby would arrange to have the Maiden shipped to Germany. In a bit of medical trickery, Christopher had to break off one of his teeth and cut off his own finger, placing it strategically in the dead guy's thigh so the body would be identified as his. Hell, what was one finger and a chipped tooth compared to escape from his debtors and billions? Besides, if he hadn't taken such elaborate measures to ensure his own safety, he'd probably have been killed years ago by one of his connections. But framing Rosemary had been Peter's idea. Thomas went along with it reluctantly because he had to. He needed Peter. Even now, 12 years later, the memory of how he'd smeared her blouse with his blood and torn a button off and placed it with the dead body disturbed him occasionally. Still, better Rosemary should die than he. That's probably how she would have wanted it anyhow. That was always the problem with her in the first place. The more she gave him, the more he despised her. She'd never understood that. Poor Rosemary. And so Peter Hewson, the tipsy socialite, and Christopher Thomas, the former curator with an eye for the art market and connections, made a perfect team. They despised each other, of course, but so did half the Allied commanders during World War II. Thomas loved his history. Over the past decade, they'd stolen hundreds of millions worth of art and artifacts and placed them privately overseas, generally one or two pieces at a time. A Renoir from a university museum in upstate New York, a jewel-encrusted medieval chalice from a fashion magnate in Milan, a Picasso from a foundation in Barcelona, a Manet from a secret pied-à-terre that a philanthropist kept for his mistress. No police reports on that one, unsurprisingly, and there were more to come. But right now he had one thing on his mind, escape. As fast as he could. John Nunn was no longer a cop, but he was still nosing around. After the botched heist, it was only a matter of time before Nunn learned of Hewson's involvement and the path would lead to Thomas himself, if it hadn't already. Then there was the phone call. A fast, clean escape wasn't as difficult or unanticipated as it seemed. Christopher Thomas had always known that he risked being found out and that he might have to bail at any moment. He had an escape plan, millions in cash, gold and international banks, his safe house in Brazil. He placed a call to his private charter service and had them stand by. Thomas now strode into his bedroom and pulled the American touristers out from under the bed. Voitan, he didn't even own any. What is somebody going to steal, a suitcase from Macy's or a $1,000 one? Why are people such idiots? In 5 minutes, he'd packed all his clothes. He'd drive himself to the Oakland airport, leave the rental car in long-term parking where it wouldn't be noticed for 2 or 3 months. Thomas looked around the hotel room. Where was that other suitcase? The doorbell rang. He looked through the peephole. Grimacing, he opened the door. Artie Ruby stood there, hip-cocked, looking... jaunty was the word that came to mind. The man was wearing a rumpled suit that he might have owned when they'd first met more than a decade ago. He blinked uncertainly as he gazed at Thomas, then his eyes took in the deformed hand.
Chris, it is you.
A sigh. And you're the one who called, Artie.
Holy moly! I never saw the new face. You look... Jesus, what'd they do, move bones around or something?
Thomas looked over the man's shoulder. Don't worry, I wasn't followed. Took me hours because I doubled back 3 times. Satisfied, Thomas muttered, how did you find me? Little bird sang, what the fuck does that mean?
I went to see Peter. He was drunk and he let slip where he thought you were. Relax.
I see that look. I didn't tell nobody. I've kept everything a secret all these years. Artie snickered.
That Peter just can't keep his mouth shut.
No, he can't. That's true. Artie was looking around, impressed. The hotel room was twice the size of Artie's entire apartment. His shabby shoes left mud stains on the carpet. So, Thomas asked, because the script called for it.
We're adults, right, Chris? Businessmen?
No, I am, and you're nothing. Now get to the point.
Funny. Okay, I know that some shit is going to hit the fan pretty soon. I want to get out of the country.
And you want the number for the airport shuttle? Artie's face hardened.
You know what I'm here about.
Money, of course. So you're blackmailing me. Artie paused as if offended.
I just want to be compensated like everybody else.
You already have been.
But not enough.
Artie grinned, cocky. How much?
Enough to live on for the rest of my life.
That could be pocket change. Artie's eyes widened and he blurted.
If you hurt me, there's a letter I've written and given to somebody. If anything happens, it gets delivered. It's got everything in it, Chris. Faking your death, getting the body into the Iron Maiden, shipping it off to Germany.
Well, I'm not in the mood to argue with you. How much are you talking? People invariably underbid themselves.
$5 million.
Thomas adamantly shook his head. You're crazy. I could do one, maybe.
Three.
Two. Artie grumbled.
Okay. But cash.
I can get it.
No way, Jose. I mean now.
Why do you use all those cliches, Jose?
Huh?
Never mind. Artie, I mean, I can get the money from the other room. Now. The man blinked. Thomas added, but the problem is this letter you were mentioning. You spend the $2 million and you're going to come back for more.
No. I won't.
You say that, but of course you would.
A frown.
Wait, here's a thought. I'll pay you $2 million now. Then, when you're safe somewhere, I'll meet this guy who has the letter, your brother-in-law or lawyer or whoever.
Yeah, it's a lawyer, I know.
I'll meet him. And if he gives me the letter unopened, I'll give him another $1 million for you. How's that sound?
Yeah?
Artie rubbed his face and looked like a kid who'd just been told school was canceled for the day.
Deal!
He stuck out an unclean hand. Thomas ignored the gesture. Walking into the bedroom, he heard Artie say, "Man, this is one kick-ass bar. You mind if I help myself to a short one?"
"Go right ahead."
Christopher Thomas did have several million dollars in the bedroom, an amount that probably weighed more than scrawny Artie was able to lift, let alone cart off. But instead of the money, Thomas walked to his dresser and withdrew a Colt Python 357 Magnum. Though the diameter of the bullet was smaller than a 38, 44, or 45, the load was massive, and the hollow point slug would mushroom instantly upon hitting human flesh and fling the victim to the floor as if struck by a car. Hand at his side, he returned to the living room, where he found Artie, not with a short one, but with a glass full to the rim with single malt scotch that cost $800 a bottle. He was slavering like a spaniel.
"For a dead man, you got some nice shit here," Artie gasped as he saw the gun. The glass crashed to the floor.
"No, don't shoot me."
"I've often said people should die just because they're stupid. Blackmailing me, Artie?"
The letter, I'm not kidding. It tells everything."
Thomas could only laugh.
A minute ago, Arnie had told him how to find the letter, if there even was a letter. And later in the night, before anybody noticed Artie was missing and Thomas was long gone, he would have some of his minders comb through Artie's apartment and get the name of every lawyer he'd ever had contact with. The muscle would make sure the letter, if it existed, was recovered unopened. Or maybe they'd just kill the shyster. Either way. Thomas drew back the hammer of the weapon with a click and aimed.
"No! Please!"
He began to pull the trigger.
Chapter 30 by Jeff Abbott. The gathering last night had felt haunted by the restless ghosts of Rosemary and Christopher Thomas. Now the forensic anthropologist's words had shoved one of those ghosts from shadow into light, dissolving him. Because Christopher Thomas might well still walk the earth. John Nunn felt breath surge back into his chest. The numbness that had clutched him since he'd realized Rosemary could well have been innocent began to ease its awful grip. But if Christopher Thomas wasn't dead, where was he? The meeting had now broken up, and everyone had begun to drift away, and none knew that too many questions and uncertainties clouded their minds. He watched them go, not wanting to talk to anyone. No one spoke to him. No one met his gaze. What kind of detective was he that he could have been fooled? Never mind the evidence. He always doubted Rosemary's guilt, but he'd ignored the doubts. Full speed ahead to conviction, to make everyone, except himself, and Rosemary tragically, content, and certain that justice had been served. A hot, sudden anger at the waste of it all tore through him, and he leaned against the wall. He closed his eyes, then opened them again. A painting hung to his left. A wild modernist smear of blue and orange and white in a chaotic tango. A painting, a creation, with a meaning and a pattern he didn't understand. Creation. Pattern. Death. Rosemary's death, and the death of his own marriage and career, that extraordinary lie had been someone's creation. Crafted with the careful touch of an artist, with an underlying pattern, a foundation, that he'd failed to see. Why? A framing of this sort implied cold calculation, not passion. And for such a crime, he had one rule that he should always have obeyed with unbending focus. Follow the money. In this case, the money took the form of one sodden, rotten Peter Hewson. Nunn stepped away from the chaotic modernist painting. He looked around. Everyone was gone. the living and the ghosts of the twisted, lying past. Maybe everyone had fled from him. The cop who had built the case against Rosemary, the cop who had been so wrong. He must smell of failure and regret and incompetence. A wave of nausea surged through him and he thought, I am going to find out the truth. An ember suddenly fanned into flame in his heart. I am going to find out the truth. Maybe Rosemary was innocent. Maybe Rosemary had killed the person the world assumed was Christopher. He wanted to know. Follow the money. He wanted to talk to Peter. His footsteps echoed in the emptiness. The painting watched him as though measuring his resolve. He nodded at the security guard waiting for him to leave. He exited the McFall out into the damp, foggy blanket of night. The wet chill cut through him. The glowing stars were smears behind the clouds. He saw a figure in the shadows of the looming art museum. Along the deserted sidewalk, walking with a momentary unsteadiness, Peter? Nunn hurried forward, walking on the balls of his feet, silently. The fog parted, cut by a knife of streetlight, and he saw it wasn't Peter, it was Stan Ballard, reaching into his pocket for a cell phone, bringing it up to his face. Maybe Sarah is calling him, Nunn thought. Sarah preferred a liar and a scumbag like Stan Ballard over him. What's wrong with me? Nunn thought. What's wrong with her? Their marriage seemed like one of those modern paintings. The foundation lost in the wild chaos. Had Sarah ever loved him? Ballard turned into an alleyway, eschewing the warm comforts of a cafe and a bar another block down the fogged street. Ballard wanted privacy in the wake of the shocking revelations. Interesting. Nunn stopped at the corner, risked a glance down the alleyway. Dumpsters and crates from the cafe lined the pavement. He could see Ballard moving behind a dumpster, and Nunn hurried forward, his hand going to his gun, the relic of the cop he used to be. Odd that the urge to wear a sidearm and bring handcuffs to the museum had taken him. The visible proof that he still thought himself a police officer, although he wasn't. But he was grateful for his idiosyncrasy now. Ballard's voice made a low hiss into the phone. It's all going to come out! What we did to make money off the estate! Panic touching the words, poisoning them. He sensed the presence behind him and turned. So Nunn simply stuck his service pistol into Ballard's cheek. Ballard froze, pale with shock. Nunn put a finger to his lips. Ballard stayed mute. Nunn snapped fingers at the phone. Ballard handed it over. Nunn put the phone to his ears. The rant blurted into his ear. Shut up! Shut up about it! Peter Hewson slurring words in a whiskey drawl. Nunn made a noise of assent. I don't care, Stan. We're safe, we're fine, we're, best of all, we're cool. We're beyond cool. We're icy. We are non-globally warmed. Peter's voice cracked into hard, brittle laughter. It doesn't matter whatever you say that CSI guy said. It doesn't matter. Because we can't be caught. The money is yours, mine, and ours. Nunn grunted, and as Peter launched into another drunken tirade of reassurance, Nunn covered the phone and whispered to Ballard, Tell him to stay put. Tell him you want to come to see him. Now. Don't take no for an answer. You won't. Ballard's gaze darted to the gun against his cheek. I will, Nunn whispered, Nothing to lose, man. You made sure of that. You're the one with everything to lose, Stan. Do as I say. Nunn put the phone back up to Ballard's face. Yes, Peter, I'm here. Ballard's voice was steady. The lawyer in him kicked in. He would not show he was rattled, not to an audience, or to an accomplice. I want to see you. Now. A pause. No, not at a bar. Stay in your boat. You're not in any condition to be in public again tonight. I'll be there shortly. All right. Yes, Peter, goodbye. Nunn clicked off the phone. If only I had a tape recorder so I could prove to the world what a complete waste of skin you are. Ballard risked a half-smile. You just assaulted me and listened in on a private conversation. I'll sue you into complete financial oblivion unless you just turn around and walk away. You think you hit bottom after Sarah dumped you? You're still a mile above bottom. But I will crash you, Nunn. Crashing is my hobby, Nunn said. I'm in Olympic training for hitting bottom, Stan. Seriously. I'm impressed with the level of jackassery you've managed. You helped Peter bilk the Thomas kids out of millions after their mother, his own sister, was executed. If only they gave medals for class and integrity. Ballard's mouth worked and decided on a frown. You're making a huge assumption. No, that's what I used to do. Assume. No more. Show me your wallet and your car keys, Stan. Ballard fished out his wallet and keys. A Mercedes logo gleamed on the keychain. Nunn thumbed through the thick wallet. You're living so much larger than when Rosemary marched off to the death chamber. You and Peter raiding the family funds? It's hard for a dead woman to ask for an audit. Ballard didn't move. Didn't answer. Peter's a jerk, but he's also a drunk, and not exactly a guy you'd entrust with a plan, Nunn said. The need to twist the knife in Ballard ran deep through Nunn's bones. Part of him, wrongly he knew, wanted to pull the trigger and make Ballard's usually sneering face disappear. But then he thought of Sarah. Did she really love this man? Did she even know him? What? Ballard, usually so sharp, didn't see Nunn's meaning. Someone hatched a plan to put a body in that Iron Maiden and frame Rosemary. It's a crime that required a great deal of forethought and planning. You sound like a textbook. You're sleeping with my wife, and I have a gun. So mocking me wouldn't be a smart strategy. Ballard said, Your ex-wife. Nunn cut him off. The candidate pool is thin, Stan. You're smarter than Peter, and your motive isn't so obvious as Peter's would be. If Peter profits, you profit. Ballard's mouth twitched, moved, turned into a frown of disbelief. You only say that because of Sarah. Because you want to believe the worst of me. I don't want. I do believe the worst of you. Tell me what you and Peter did. This wasn't my plan. Nunn shoved the gun harder into Ballard's cheek. The flesh went red in the dim light. Whose plan? Ballard didn't answer. You think I won't kill you? You won't. You love Sarah too much to kill me. The awful truth of Ballard's words, the blunt truth coming from a man he knew to be a liar, burned into Nunn's brain. He pictured Sarah in Ballard's